Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service. Because nobody likes waiting around. You listening, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
The open road feels even better with CME Federal Credit Union. CME wants to beat your current auto loan rate by 1.5% APR and give you a fresh start with no payments for 60 days, whether it's tailgates, pumpkin patches, or road trips through Ohio's back roads. Let CME help you cozy up to savings and make this season one to remember. Terms and conditions apply. Minimum floor rate of 4.99% APR. APR means annual percentage rate, federally insured by NCUA. Visit cmefcu.org for additional details.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
What happens after we die? This is a question as old as humanity itself, pondered by philosophers, theologians, and frankly, everybody else. But there's more to this question than the philosophical or spiritual. And that's because a person's death triggers an avalanche of very real, very tangible events. Estates need to be settled, debts paid and assets divided. Everything we leave behind must be sorted, claimed, and distributed. This is the world of probate, a legal process that can be as mundane as it is complicated. Probate determines the fate of a deceased person's estate, ensuring that their final wishes are honored, or in some cases, exploited. At the heart of this process, in some jurisdictions, is a public administrator, a role designed to help families during these often difficult times. Their job is to manage the estates of those who die without a will, or in cases where no next of kin can be located or identified. Public administrators ensure assets are appropriately distributed. But when millions of dollars are at stake, the temptation for corruption can be overwhelming. And in Las Vegas, a city built on fortunes and secrets, the role of one public administrator would lead to a deadly collision between powers and politics and the pursuit of truth. Join me now as we take a look at the murder of Jeff Gehrman, a seasoned journalist known for uncovering the hidden truths of Las Vegas. You'll hear how a small-time scoop about a lowly public official upended a local political race, shattering a politician's career, and how it led to a brutal confrontation that shook not only the entire city, but newsrooms around the world. In the years following the release of Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the number of university students studying archaeology skyrocketed worldwide. Suddenly, everyone wanted to be an archaeologist, no doubt envisioning themselves wearing a fedora and wielding a bullwhip. But Indiana Jones wasn't the first hero to popularize an entire profession. Less than a decade before, two real-life journalists, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, became legends as they broke the Watergate scandal in 1972 for the Washington Post. Almost instantly, enrollment at journalism schools across the United States doubled. More people than ever wanted to be a journalist. But not just any journalist. An investigative journalist, wielding a typewriter and notebook full of confidential sources. Jeff Gehrman was one of those students. During the Watergate years, Jeff majored in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. But when Richard Nixon formally resigned from the presidency in 1974, he quickly shifted his focus to journalism. After graduation, Jeff stayed in Milwaukee and pursued his master's in journalism at Marquette University. Fresh out of grad school and looking to make a name for himself, Jeff accepted a position at the Las Vegas Sun and drove out west. For an aspiring investigative journalist, Vegas in the late 1970s was a dream come true. Perhaps because there was no better city in the United States to dig for crime, corruption, and intrigue. Many of Jeff's scandalous stories also involved the police, lawyers, and corrupt judges. While these stories made Jeff a popular name in the press, he had undoubtedly made a number of enemies on the streets. But not all the stories Jeff pursued had an element of danger. Many were much more mundane. By 2022, Jeff was 69 years old and writing for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, the largest newspaper in the state of Nevada. With 40 years of experience, he was one of the most seasoned investigative journalists in the entire city. In April, Jeff received a tip from a colleague about a story that seemed of little significance. It was rumored that trouble was brewing at the Clark County Office of the Public Administrator, a tiny office with just 8 full-time employees that oversaw the estates of those who died without a will in Las Vegas. Several employees had reached out to complain about an incredibly hostile work environment. Since the newly elected public administrator, Robert Tellis, took over, they claimed he ran the office like a tyrant, bullying and traumatizing the employees who'd worked there for years. Some even filed official complaints against their new boss. But because Robert was an elected official, little could be done about it. According to the bitter employees, led by Assistant Public Administrator Rita Reed, Robert belittled his employees and made them fear retaliation for minor infractions. He also banned the use of cell phones at the office and instituted a no-socializing policy. Among these accusations was another, more scandalous one. It was alleged that Robert, who was a married man, was having a sexual affair with a subordinate, married staffer Roberta Lee Kennett. And they claimed Roberta had secured power and privileges over the other employees because of this personal relationship. To prove the affair, several employees followed Robert and Roberta to a parking garage where they'd scheduled a secret rendezvous. On several occasions, they videotaped the couple getting into the back seat of Roberta's car. Although the footage doesn't clearly show what's going on in the back seat, based on the way the shadows are moving, it's obvious they were doing more than talking. When Jeff saw the footage, he was convinced. But like every story, there's always another side. Robert and Roberta denied the affair, and Robert stated the public administrator's office was doing better than ever. Born in 1976, Robert comes from a long line of family politicians in El Paso, Texas. His dad was a city councilman, his grandfather a county commissioner, and even a great uncle appointed by JFK to be the ambassador of Costa Rica. But despite the pedigree, Robert always considered himself a self-made man.
Out of high school, I got a job at a small computer store, you know, building computers, that type of thing. And then I got an opportunity to work in IT, working as a network technician. The dot-com crash occurred, and from there I ended up going into property management. I became a leasing agent, then an assistant manager, then a manager. Then I took a strange turn and got into maintenance, fixing stuff inside apartments, that type of thing. And from there, started to get involved in air conditioners. So then I became an HVAC technician, an air conditioning technician. And it was all, self-study. I kind of learned like the basics of air conditioning on my own.
While Robert worked as an HVAC technician by day and attended law school at night, he met his second wife, Mary. Robert and Mary both had children from previous relationships, but it wasn't long that they had a daughter together.
When I got out of law school, I opened my own probate firm, or my own law firm, and I focused on probate, working cases for families. And John Cahill, the public administrator at the time, he saw me in court and, saw that I was kind of a new face. So I started doing some work for him. And I can't remember exactly how long I've been working for him, at least a few months, maybe 6 months. But I was part of this volunteer group, and we had these weekly meetings where we would bring people in to speak, right? And the group was very interested in learning about things happening in Vegas, right? So I thought, well, gosh, getting the Clark County Public Administrator in to speak would be really great because nobody knows what this guy does.
Robert's professional relationship with the county's public administrator would change the course of his life forever when John Cahill decided to retire and Robert was selected as his replacement and was endorsed by him in the next election.
Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service because nobody likes waiting around. You listen in, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
Calling all fun lovers and memory makers. Texas invites you to cheer from our stadiums and dance like no one is watching. Culture seekers can find the art that truly inspires.
Wow.
And from our shopping hubs to our chic boutiques, fashionistas will never leave empty-handed. Texas is an unforgettable experience that's waiting just for you. Visit TravelTexas.com and plan your trip today. Let's Texas.
Robert won the election easily, but wasn't in office long before he uncovered some corruption of his own. It had to do with the Independent Administrations Act, a Nevada law allowing basically anyone, corporate or private, to become executor of an estate, as long as they first file a petition with the courts. Nevada attorney Robert Draskovich explains.
You have people who die. They don't have wills. They may not have heirs. They may not have estates. And unfortunately for them, their legacy is stolen by these third parties. Under this Independent Administrations Act, there are third parties who would come in, oftentimes with no announcement to the family members, take the properties, devalue the properties, and then turn around and sell them to a straw buyer, and ultimately sell them again and make millions of dollars. Robert Tallis was determined to stop that, regardless of the consequences.
Under Nevada law, the county's probate commissioner was required to grant an independent administrator's petition if no one else objected. And that's when Robert discovered that his predecessor had a policy of never objecting to these third-party petitions.
The probate commissioner had these concerns with some of these folks. I was in a hearing one day where he asked me to take a look at a case, and he told me that his client had been doing these things for so much time, and the prior public administrator didn't have a concern with it. He was very troubled by what he saw going on. And so I told him, no, I've been at this for maybe 7-8 months, and this is the first time hearing of it.
Basically, it was open season for greedy real estate companies to flip houses and make a quick profit. And once Robert became wise to the scheme, he started digging into the details. And that's when, according to him, he discovered that one company called Compass Realty was the worst offender. After gaining independent administrator status on the property, they would first devalue it.
And I noted that in this case, we found that he had removed everything from the kitchen before any sale of the home. Removing the kitchen before the sale would devalue the property in a way that would allow a lower appraisal value before making the sale. The kitchen was in place at the time that the decedent died.
After deliberately devaluing the property, the company would then sell it to a straw buyer, another person, often an employee of the same company, for a discounted price. The straw buyer would then flip the house very quickly and resell it at a hefty profit, a profit that should have gone to the families.
For about 60 cases, there's about a $6 million difference between the time that the estate sold the property to the time that the person who purchased it sold it to another person. Originally, the estates in total sold the properties for $8.5 million, and later the people who sold it after, they sold it for about $14.5 million, right? So when you're talking about $8.5 million and then making $6 million, I mean, it's nearly doubled from one sale to the next sale. For example, there's this one, the estate sold the home on December 31st of 2018 for $232,000. And the next sale was done the same day. So the person who bought it resold it the same day for $50,000 more. Administrators have a fiduciary duty to get the maximum value that they can for the estate. When I see a significant difference between the one price and the other price, it's just not right.
Robert then made it his policy to object to any petitions made by corporate independent administrators. He also took what he found to the Las Vegas Metro Police and spoke with Detective Derek Jappe.
Some of those allegations were that Compass Realty was not notifying the next of kin that they were taking possession of their residence. Secondly, that they were filing false documents to the court, not showing the actual value of the residence, as well as they were selling the residences to employees of Compass Realty, which would be a violation of that statute.
Detective Jappe would eventually send the case over to the DA's office, but the DA declined to pursue the case. When Jeff Gehrman interviewed Robert in 2022 about the turmoil within the office, Robert explained that many of the accusations against him were simply due to the fact he was upsetting the apple cart in a dramatic way. He believed that Compass Realty was influencing the complaints against him because he cut off their gravy train of quick money. To support this claim, he pointed out the fact that his assistant administrator, Rita Reed, was now going to run against him for office in the upcoming election primary, which was just a few months away. And one of her campaign donors was Compass Realty. Just 1 month before the primary election between Rita and Robert, Jeff published his expose titled County Office in Turmoil with Secret Video and Claims of Bullying Hostility. The article was a devastating blow to Robert's political aspirations and potentially his marriage as well. Robert did his best to deny the accusations, but in the primary election in June 2022, Robert lost to his challenger, Rita Reed, by the slimmest of margins. Yet, even though the election was over, Jeff continued digging into Robert and finding more dirt. In total, he published 3 follow-up articles detailing Robert's downfall. In August, Robert received notification that Jeff had placed an official records request for all email communications between Robert and Roberta Lee Kennett. It was clear Jeff was still investigating his alleged affair. Then, on September 1st, 2002, Robert learned Jeff's records request had been approved. The following morning, September 2nd, Las Vegas resident Holly Bailey woke up at her middle-class suburban home. She and her husband Roy lived in a friendly cul-de-sac called Bronze Circle, and for the past 27 years, they lived across the street from Jeff Gehrman. But that morning, when Holly looked across the way, she noticed something strange.
He never leaves his garage door open, and I noticed it was open and his car was in there. I was running errands that morning, and then when I came home a little while later, around noon, I think it was open and it's never open. I had that feeling of angst, like something was wrong. So I'm really busy, so I just continued on. I spoke with my neighbor. She told me, you know, it's strange. I said, I know I already called him or texted him. I can't remember what it was.
After repeatedly trying to contact Jeff throughout the day, Holly and Roy decided to be good neighbors and close his garage door for him.
My husband and I walk over there, and I pulled the cord, and he pulled the garage door down. Directly before, I sent him an email, and I said, okay, this is what we're going to do. I haven't heard from you, so I'm assuming maybe we think you left town and you don't have your phone or something, but your garage door's up, and I hope you're not mad, but we're going to go over there and close your garage door for you.
When the neighbors still hadn't heard from Jeff the next morning, September 3rd, they considered contacting police to ask for a welfare check. But before they could, Roy decided to go over to the house and check one last time. Minutes later, Holly heard screaming.
And I said, what's going on? You know, what happened? And I ran out there to my husband, and he was on the phone with 911. And he was in shock, and I went into shock. And he was having a hard time.
Walking over, Roy discovered Jeff's body on the ground beside his house amongst some bushes. His shirt was covered in blood, and he'd obviously been deceased for some time. When police arrived to examine the scene, they discovered that a fatal slash across Jeff's neck had severed his carotid artery. Three more stab wounds were discovered on his neck, as well as three penetrating wounds to his body. His arms and hands were covered in defensive wounds. It was estimated that Jeff would have died within minutes of the attack. Upon inspection, detectives discovered that none of Jeff's valuable personal items had been taken, neither from his pockets nor from his house. Detectives then caught a break when they learned that the neighbors had a security camera. And when they looked at the footage, they were stunned to see that the entire murder had been captured the day before, on September 2nd, at 11:18 a.m. The footage showed a man walking past Jeff's garage and into the bushes beside his house, wearing a bright orange vest, the same style that road construction workers wear. He was also wearing dark blue jeans, gray Nike running shoes, and a large straw sun hat with a brim so wide and floppy, it completely obstructed the assailant's face. Over his shoulder, he was carrying a sizable gray duffel bag. Minutes later, Jeff's garage door opened, and he walked out in shorts and a t-shirt. And while there's no sound in the video, something clearly drew his attention to the side of the house, because he then walked over into the bushes where the murderer ambushed him. 2 minutes later, the killer emerged from the bushes and casually walked back down the street. Knowing what the killer was wearing, lead detective Justine Gaddis directed her team to scour the neighborhood for any surveillance footage that might reveal more.
So with this, actually, we ended up employing other patrol detectives to help us because it was that extensive. Typically, we go to the last place that we know that either the image of the vehicle or the image of the person was seen, and we almost kind of like just leapfrog down the street. We'll make a game plan ahead of time. There's businesses there, businesses that we've pulled video from before. So sometimes we have like previous contacts to where we can just make phone calls. But a lot of the time it's literally walking the street, driving the street, and just leapfrogging after each other to follow whatever we're looking for, whether it's a person or a vehicle.
After reviewing several security cameras in the neighborhood, police discovered footage of the killer getting into an SUV parked just down the street, a red 2007 GMC Yukon Denali with tinted rear windows. Although police couldn't see a license plate number, they did find there was approximately 67 red Denalis in Las Vegas, and they believed their killer's car was on the list. Detectives also caught another important break during Jeff's autopsy when foreign DNA was discovered under the fingernails of Jeff's right hand, which meant Jeff might have scratched the killer during the attack. It didn't take Detective Gaddis long before she learned the bigger picture surrounding Jeff's death, and suddenly, the number of possible suspects grew exponentially. For the past 40 years, Jeff had been making enemies and ruffling feathers of some very powerful people, exposing mobsters, corrupt judges, politicians, and political extremists.
We received emails, phone calls, there was Crime Stopper tips that came in.
The number of tips increased when Las Vegas police released images and video of the killer in the vehicle to the public. Many of the tipsters pointed the finger at Robert. But the major breakthrough came when detectives revisited their list of registered red Denalis in Las Vegas. On that list was a woman named Mary Ismail, who turned out to be Robert's wife. After learning Robert and Mary lived approximately 5 miles from Jeff's house, they were able to find additional surveillance footage for more than 24 cameras between Robert and Jeff's addresses on the day of the murder. Remarkably, surveillance footage was able to track the killer's red Denali from an area just outside Robert's home to Jeff's house at the time he was murdered, and then back to Robert's neighborhood again. Detectives then searched Robert's phone records and discovered that his cell phone had never left his house between approximately 9 a.m. and noon on September 2nd, the exact same time frame the red Denali was seen on security cameras. They also noticed a number of unanswered incoming calls and texts during that time, but notably, not a single outgoing call or text was recorded. Detectives theorized Robert had left his cell phone at home, then drove his wife's SUV while wearing the disguise of a construction worker, and murdered Jeff in broad daylight. On the morning of September 7th, Robert was detained by police. Detectives secured warrants to collect his DNA, as well as search his home. While arresting Robert, they noticed a Band-Aid on his left ring finger, and when asked to remove it, it revealed he'd nearly cut the tip of his finger off with a knife. Robert blamed it on a kitchen accident, but detectives suspected otherwise. Inside Robert's house, they discovered a trove of damning evidence. Hidden discreetly behind the footrest of his couch, detectives found a pair of gray Nikes that matched the killer's. Oddly, one of those shoes had been cut in half, likely with scissors. They also found a Ziploc bag filled with hundreds of tiny cut-up bits of rubber, which appeared to be the missing half of the shoe. In Robert's garage, detectives found a large gray duffel bag that matched the one the killer had been carrying. Nearby, in a plastic bag, were pieces of straw hat that had been deliberately cut apart. Putting the pieces together like a puzzle, there was no doubt it was the exact same hat the killer had worn. The overwhelming evidence against Robert was stacking up, but detectives wanted to wait for Robert's DNA test results before making an arrest. They wanted to see if the foreign DNA under Jeff's fingernails was a match. For the time being, Robert was free to return home. But just a few hours later, police arrived to arrest him. The DNA from Jeff's fingernails was a perfect match to Robert. But instead of coming outside and allowing police to take him in, Robert barricaded himself inside his home. Detective Jappy, who worked closely with Robert on the Compass Realty corruption case, spoke with Robert on the phone to convince him to give himself up. According to Arthur Kane's book, The Last Story, Robert then attempted to hang himself by using his own clothes. And when that attempt failed, he crawled into his bathtub and slit his wrists. Robert describes his mindset at the time.
I knew I didn't do this thing, and yet the police claimed to have this evidence. I have a $1 million life insurance policy. I didn't want my family to have to go through more torture. And so I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought, you know what, if I can avoid the pain that they're gonna suffer during this whole circus and put some money into their hands to make up for me not being there, then maybe this is the thing to do.
Detective Jappy was on the phone with him the whole time.
There's multiple statements that he wasn't thinking clearly and that he was thinking about hurting himself. And then it progressed to where he was telling me that he could not exit the residence because he was stuck in his tub. And at that point, we, members of the SWAT team, utilized robots and drones to see that he was, in fact, laying in his tub and unable to exit.
Eventually, police went inside and rescued Robert and then brought him outside on a gurney and took him to a hospital where he was treated for his wounds. He was then arrested and charged with murder. Prosecutors already had what they considered to be a slam dunk against Robert. But remarkably, Robert claimed he was completely innocent. Practically from day one, Robert told anyone who'd listen that he'd been framed.
I did not cut up a shoe and hide it under my couch. I did not cut up a hat and put it in an open door of my toolbox. I did not kill Mr. Gurman. So I did not take a bag with my children's basketball and football out of the bin and use it during the commission of a murder.
According to him, he'd been at his house all morning and his cell phone had been with him the entire time. He explained the calls and texts he ignored were either spam or simply not urgent, and that he'd only left to take a short walk. As for who was responsible for Jeff's murder, Robert had a theory. He believed he'd been framed by Compass Realty, the company he'd threatened to take down. He also believed the employees who'd run him out of office were also a part of it. The basis of his theory stems from a separate investigation into Robert that began just weeks before Jeff's murder. An investigation into allegations that Robert was attempting to solicit bribes from his real estate agents. And this is where it gets a bit complicated, because this new investigation was also led by Detective Jappy.
And in early August, Rita Reed and Alicia Goodwin approached him. And after they approached him, that Kimberly McMahon approached him. And you heard that Kimberly McMahon was somebody who worked as a real estate agent for me at the public administrator's office. And she had raised these allegations of a bribery scheme that I asked her for commissions and or for a referral fee.
Kimberly McMahon was a realtor Robert had done business with in the past. She also happened to be a recently retired lieutenant with the Las Vegas Metro Police. Suddenly, Detective Jappy was working on two cases involving Robert, investigating Compass Realty and the bribery accusations against him. According to Robert, this was evidence of a surreptitious connection between Compass Realty, the disgruntled employees, and the Las Vegas PD. He theorized that an assassin hired by his enemies had killed Jeff Gehrman with the sole purpose of framing him for murder. He then insinuated that Detective Jappy had played a major role implanting the damning evidence inside his home. Likewise, he claimed that the DNA found under Jeff's fingerprints must have also been planted. The trial of Robert Tellis for the murder of Jeff Gehrman began on August 15, 2024, nearly 2 years after Jeff's murder. Over the course of 4 days, the prosecution presented an overwhelming case against Robert. Along with all the other irrefutable physical evidence and surveillance footage, police also obtained a massive cache of deleted images from Robert's phone. More than 100 screenshots from Google Maps Street View showing the exterior of Jeff's house on Bronze Circle. Timestamps revealed the images had been accessed in August 2022. The prosecution contended that Robert started plotting to kill Jeff just days after he became aware of Jeff's records request, the one that would expose all his personal emails between Robert and his alleged lover at the office. Not only had Jeff's reporting ruined Robert's entire political career, but now he was threatening to ruin his marriage as well. This, they claimed, was the motive behind the murder. Against the advice of his own lawyer, Robert took the stand in his own defense. Robert spent the bulk of his 2-day testimony attempting to explain the corruption he'd uncovered during his time as public administrator. He repeatedly denied murdering Jeff and explained the conspiracy he believed was behind him being framed. He claimed that all the evidence in his home had been planted, that the DNA results were planted, and that all the incriminating data on his phone was the result of being hacked. At the end of his testimony, the prosecution gave the most scathing cross-examinations we've ever heard.
And the very spot that his body is lying is inside your phone.
That is very strange.
And if they hated you so much, why didn't they just kill you?
That's a really good question, and I would like to answer it. Look, my belief as to why they
please
didn't.
Tell me why they didn't just bother killing you.
Because if they'd killed me, would that have stopped Nevada State Division from investigating them? No. If they killed me, would anybody have felt the duty to continue my work because I was actually doing this? I think so. So murdering me would have not discredited me. It would not have put me in a position where all the work that I was doing just got left by the wayside. It would make no sense to kill me.
So your theory is that Jeff Gehrman is collateral damage?
When you've taken into account the fact that months earlier we had this public feud, it's a pretty convenient way to do this.
So the guy who writes the articles that ends your career, they reward him by killing him?
Well, again, like I said, it was a pretty good way to do this.
And let's not get it twisted. Rita and Alicia are part of the conspiracy that loop in Jeff Gehrman, and they're in cahoots with Compass. So they're like, you know what? Thanks, Jeff, but you got to go? That's what you're suggesting?
And like I said, I don't know that they knew about that particular aspect of the conspiracy, sir.
The prosecutor even got Robert to admit that he lied to Jeff Gehrman about his affair with a coworker.
When you spoke with him, were you truthful in your interview?
Not entirely, no.
Okay. What were you untruthful about?
About the extent of the relationship with me and Roberta Lee Kennett.
Okay. What was different? What did you say versus the truth?
I said that, you know, she and I had no affair. But, you know, regrettably, we did have, when I say regrettably, I think we both regret the mistake, but we had a romantic affair with each other.
Okay, so you did lie to him, correct, on that topic?
I didn't think that was for the public's business.
That's not my question. My question
is... I did lie regarding that particular issue, yes.
Central to Robert's alibi was his claim of being home at the time of the murder. His wife, Mary, didn't testify, neither confirming nor denying she was at home with Robert. According to Robert, he'd gone for a walk, and since he was coming home soon, he didn't see the need to respond immediately to his wife's messages. At 10:35 on the day of the murder, Mary had texted Robert a photo of their daughter. About 10 minutes later, she called Robert's phone but he didn't answer.
And then your wife called and you just didn't want to like get to her, get back to her. And that was kind of what happened with that. Is that correct?
Right. I was really close to home. I was going to walk in the door. And so why?
Right. And I think you said, honey, I'm home, right?
Something along those lines.
Because May was home at that time.
Right.
Okay. And that was just minutes later, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't any concern. It was just a picture of your daughter in this call. You were just going to take care of it, right?
Right.
Okay. Nothing else?
As far as like messages and things go, or?
Anything else you want to add to this, sir?
I don't think so.
After baiting Robert to stand by his story in front of the jury, the prosecutor shocked the entire courtroom.
Did you ever watch Steve Jobs' presentations when he would get up and say, you know, just one more thing? You ever see him do that? And he drops like a new product or anything?
No.
Never seen that before? Mm. Okay. Well, let's take a look. Before I approach, I'm just going to ask you one more time. You didn't delete anything off your phone on September 2nd of 2022, did you, sir?
Not that I recall.
Take a look at those.
The prosecutor then handed Robert photos taken from his wife's Apple Watch, specifically the text message thread between her and Robert on the morning of the murder.
Do those appear to be fair and accurate depictions of those messages?
Except there's an additional message.
Right, there's an additional message. Mm-hmm. That's your wife's Apple Watch, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, and with the exception of the one message that's off, everything else seems to be a fair and accurate depiction of your communication on that day. Isn't that right?
So it seems, yes.
That's the same picture you just told us about from your text messages, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's at 10:35, correct?
Yes.
It says Friday, correct?
Yes.
It also says Rob up in the corner, correct?
Yes.
Please read to this jury, what does it say underneath that photograph?
It says, where are you?
Where are you? You told us you were at home.
I did not. I said, actually, when I got the messages, I was still on my walk.
Let me ask you this question. That message isn't on your phone, is it?
It isn't. I mean,
yes or no? That message isn't on your phone.
Why it isn't? I wouldn't know because it.
I
apparently
didn't ask
it's not,
you why.
It's not on my wife's phone either.
Sir, I didn't ask you why. I asked you a yes or no question. That message is not on your phone, correct?
From what you showed me, it is not.
And you were in possession of your phone on that day, correct?
On that day, yes.
And you, as the owner of the phone, have the ability to save messages and delete messages, correct?
Yes.
Right. She's asking, where are you, right?
Yes.
At that same time, at 10:30 in the morning, we've seen video surveillance of a car that you say looks just like mine driving in Mr. Gehrman's neighborhood, correct?
That is correct.
While Robert was supposedly taking a short walk around his neighborhood, his wife messaged him, "Where are you?" Clearly, Robert had deliberately deleted this message from his and his wife's phones, and Robert appeared genuinely shocked to discover he hadn't deleted all traces of the message. The prosecution demonstrated the significance of this during closing arguments.
There's an incoming unanswered message from his wife saying, "Where are you?" at 10:36 a.m. Now you'd think, given that some of the allegations in the articles, this might be one he'd answer pretty quickly. There's an unanswered incoming call from his wife at 10:43 a.m. that doesn't get answered by him. And there's another incoming call that occurs at 11:16 a.m. Meanwhile, you know, he is at Mr. Gehrman's house. So ask yourself this. If this was really a Compass Realty assassin who was committing the murder at Bronze Circle, how would that individual know that Mr. Tellis, with his phone at his house, wouldn't have answered a call, or wouldn't have gotten in another text string, or wouldn't have made a call himself? How could anybody but Mr. Tellis be the killer? No one would have that level of assurance, because if any of those calls had been answered from his house, it would be clear that he wasn't the one involved.
After eviscerating Robert's alibi, the prosecution closed by addressing Robert's claims of a conspiracy against him.
And what's amazing is if you believe that story about this conspiracy, all of these people and all of these entities were willing to sacrifice their reputation, their business, their police department, even the public administrator's office. They're all willing to put it on the line to kill a reporter to get that guy, even though he's leaving in 3 months. Does that make a shred of sense? Absolutely not. But what it does give you a window into is what's in his mind. That is how important Mr. Telus views himself. That every single one of these people, every single one of these entities were literally willing to kill another human being who is not him, just to frame him. Does that make sense? The Metro Police Department was really in on a conspiracy to get the defendant, right? To truly get him. Here's a question for you. Why not let him die in the tub? Why not let that man bleed out? You had your opportunity, and yet they don't take it. Mr. Telus's life is saved that day. And who ends up saving his life? Why, it's none other than the head conspirator. It's Detective Derek Chappie. They saved his life. If the conspiracy is really true, Derek Chappie doesn't do that. Metro doesn't do that. They literally let him bleed out. But that didn't happen.
After closing arguments, Robert's case was handed over to the jury. But surprisingly, the jury didn't return with a speedy verdict. After 2 days, when they still hadn't returned with the verdict, it became clear that some members of the jury were seriously considering Robert's claims of a conspiracy. But then finally on day 3, the jury announced they'd reached a verdict.
District Court, Clark County, Nevada, State of Nevada, Plaintiff versus Robert Telus, Defendant, verdict. We, the jury in the above entitled case, find the defendant, Robert Telus, as follows. Murder with use of a deadly weapon, victim 60 years of age or older, guilty. Special verdict. The jury unanimously finds the murder willful, deliberate, and premeditated. The jury unanimously finds the murder was committed by means of lying in wait. The jury unanimously finds the murder was committed by means of elder abuse. Guilty of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon, special verdict. The jury unanimously finds the murder willful, deliberate, premeditated.
During sentencing, Jeff's sister Jill gave a heartfelt statement to the court about her brother's life.
So most of you know my brother Jeffrey to be a hard-nosed investigative reporter who went after corruption in our city. He wrote about wrongdoings by mobsters, gaming officials, politicians, corporations, basically anyone who was corrupt, and I don't think they could hide from him. He belonged to a class of journalists that are in a league of their own. Not many reporters out there will ever match his caliber in investigative journalism and storytelling. These past 2 years, it felt like I've been living in a chapter of a murder novel as it unfolds. I never imagined that Jeff himself would have become a national headline news story for his murder by a cold-blooded elected city official in broad daylight. Not only did my family lose a wonderful, loving brother and uncle, but the Las Vegas community and the world of journalism lost an amazing investigative reporter and a relentless crusader for justice. To everyone else, Jeffrey M. Gehrman was a dedicated and respected journalist. To me, my family, he was our big brother Jeff and our children's loving uncle. He is so deeply missed every day.
After hearing from the victim's family, it was up to the jury to decide Robert's sentence.
We, the jury in the above entitled case, having found the defendant, Robert Telus, guilty of murder of the first degree with use of a deadly weapon, victim 60 years of age or older, impose a sentence of life in the Nevada Department of Corrections with eligibility for parole, beginning when a minimum of 20 years has served.
Although the sentence, with a chance of parole after 20 years, was lighter than many expected, Robert Telus will remain behind bars until he's almost 70 years old. At the beginning of this episode, we asked a question: what happens after we die? After Jeff Gehrman's murder, the newsroom at the Las Vegas Review-Journal responded to this question by doing everything in its power to honor Jeff's extraordinary legacy. And they were determined not to let the stories he'd been working on die with him. Jeff's colleagues worked from his notes and completed the investigations he'd started, with his name included on the byline of each one. The Review-Journal also spent nearly 2 years in a heated battle with the Las Vegas Metro Police. The police naturally wanted access to all of Jeff's electronic devices, claiming it would help them build the case against Robert Tellis. But the journalists knew that Jeff's computer and phone contained a lifetime's worth of confidential sources, many of which may have come from inside the police department itself. The state of Nevada had one of the strongest shield laws in the entire country, giving journalists the right to protect their sources from any proceedings, even a judge. The only question was now whether or not this privilege could extend to a reporter after their death. The Review-Journal fought on Jeff's behalf to protect his sources, taking the case all the way to the Supreme Court of Nevada. The Supreme Court ruled in their favor, establishing a valuable precedent that shield law protects journalists even after their deaths. Today, Jeff's old desk at the Review-Journal sits unoccupied, like a retired jersey hanging from the rafters of a hollowed sports arena. On the wall in the newsroom are photos of Jeff and all the awards his journalism had won throughout his career. His close colleague, Arthur Kane, who worked alongside Jeff on a number of stories, wrote a book called The Last Story, which will likely go down as the definitive biography of Jeff's life. He ends the book by saying, "There is some irony and sadness in writing this book. While it was only in jest, because we never thought it would happen, Jeff and I promised to tell the other story if something like this happened. With this book, I have tried my hardest to keep that promise." Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.